Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network.
Broadcasting from the studios of Ave Maria Radio in Ann Arbor, Michigan, Al Cresta is ready for conversations of consequence. This is Cresta in the Afternoon.
And a good afternoon to you all. Happy Monday, and wishing you a very blessed Memorial Day as we all take some time today to reflect a little bit on what it means to be an American and why we take this day. You've probably seen memes about this on Facebook or other places, the internet. It's kind of the unofficial start of summer. But of course, for a lot of people, it's not a chance for barbecues and car sales. It's a time that they are grieving the loss of a loved one. And that's why we take this day to honor those people who gave their lives in defense of our freedoms. And in the first hour, we spent a lot of time talking about that. I would highly recommend you go check it out in the Cresta Guest Archives. We got a soldier's tour of Arlington, and we also heard from Father Daniel Mode, who shared stories he's learned as a military chaplain, including the very remarkable story of Father Vincent Capodanno, who gave his life in Vietnam. And also, while we're talking about this, a great book by a fellow EWTN host, Donna Marie Cooper Boyle, who also talked about, she wasn't on the program with us today, but she has been in the past, and she was on with our Epiphany program locally this morning, talking about the lives of Catholic military wives, some great prayers and reflections that she shared there. So there's lots of great resources out there for Catholics to help understand the deeper meaning behind Memorial Day. And I shared part of an article in the first hour that I'll share a little bit more of today, and that is a piece by Tim Bennett called Men Remember Memorial Day. And Tim writes, "Men, we must ensure that we take time to recognize Memorial Day for more than a day off from work. It is the incredible love of so many that must be celebrated. Consider attending a ceremony, visiting the graves of those fallen in war, or simply gathering your family for Memorial Day prayer. You may pray specifically for the causes of Father Capodanno and Father Capon, or find other means to personally and uniquely focus your family's prayer. If I may steal my friend's words, I think it is good, meaningful, and a witness against death to remember the sacrifice and love of so many who gave their lives for us." In this hour, we're going to take a little bit different direction. Very interesting concept here. There is a truth about Western culture, especially American culture, that is often overlooked. And that truth is that the U.S. sees itself as an individualist society whose people seek to realize personal goals in the world, while most in the non-West have a more passive, deferential temperament. In other words, the West sees life as a project, while many others are simply trying to survive rather than achieve. This serves as a massive obstacle for those trying to assimilate in America and will be a challenge for our country. Dr. Lawrence Mead is joining us to examine these cultural differences. This is an interview that Al conducted a few years back that we're sharing with you again today, partially because it's very interesting and partially because it's nice to just hear Al's voice again. Dr. Lawrence Mead's professor of politics and public policy at New York University, the author of the book Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Differences in American Power, and his many previous books have defined the theory behind the radical welfare reform of the 90s, which for the first time required many welfare recipients to work as a condition of aid. Since the 1980s, Dr. Mead has been an influential advisor to social policymakers in Washington at the state and local level and in several foreign countries, and will be spending the first two segments of this hour with him. And then later in this hour, we will hear a follow-up commentary from Al, looking at the origins of the achieving individual, and what that means, how that became to be such a prominent concept in the West. Al talks about that coming up in this later part of this hour. Also, we don't have a news break today, but I did want to give you an update on a news story we had last week. That was the Knights of Columbus, who had been told, there was a chapter of the Knights of Columbus in Virginia, who had been told they could not conduct a Memorial Day Mass in a federal cemetery. Allegedly, that law has been in the books for years. It was never an issue until this year. And the Knights objected, and thankfully, it sounds like they were able to have that funeral mass. Maybe have more news on that in the coming days. Lots to talk about in this hour, so we'll skip the news, and instead, let's listen to Al's conversation with Dr. Lawrence Mead. Take it away, Al.
Good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. Dr. Lawrence Mead is professor of politics and public policy at New York University, and most recently he has authored Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference, and American Power. He has many previous books that helped define the theory behind the radical welfare reform of the 1990s, which for the first time required many welfare recipients to work as a condition of aid. And since the 80s, he has been an influential advisor to social policymakers in Washington at the state and local level and in several foreign countries. His book, again, is called Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference, and American Power. And Larry, it's good to talk with you. Thanks.
Yeah, my pleasure.
Let's talk about the thesis here, because I do not think I've seen this idea developed anywhere else. But people speculate on it, but I've never seen it developed as thoroughly as you're developing it in this book. Why don't you lay it out for us? What's distinctive about it?
Okay. The main point of the book is stated actually in the very first sentence. We need to reckon with what I call cultural difference. Everyone in America is not the same in how they view life.
Right.
Most Americans are individualists who think that life is about pursuing and achieving their personal goals. And that temperament is absolutely central to how America became a great, powerful, dominant nation.
This kind of individual personal goals, then. That's,
yeah. Yeah. Okay. And, but that isn't true of everyone. There are groups in this country and countries overseas, indeed the majority of countries, that are not individualists, that don't think of life this way. They think rather in terms of cautious adjustments to the environment. They don't seek change so much as they seek to survive, to get through a day or a year, whatever. Mm-hmm. They're trying to come to terms with the outside world rather than change it. And the world that America represents, the Western world, is really unique in having this more activist, more assertive idea of what life's about. And we need to reckon with that because most of our problems, our challenges, come from groups in the country and countries overseas, which are not individualists. So we need to reckon with a cultural difference and not just assume that everyone's like us.
Yeah. There seems to be a reluctance on the part of cultural elites in America to acknowledge broad cultural differences, a positive cultural differences on the part of the West.
Yeah.
You often hear people talk about the West as money-grubbing, grasping, violent, et cetera, but rarely you see it said that the United States in particular, in a sense, is a blessing in as much as it has this, it's helped cultivate this individualist achieving sense.
That's right.
Why is that?
The main way Americans talk about culture, if they talk about it at all, they say America is a free country.
Right.
And they may very well say that freedom is a reason why America became a great, powerful nation.
Right.
That's true, but what they don't talk about is the culture that underlies freedom. The culture of freedom is really an individualist culture where people pursue personal goals, but they also take on board what I call the burdens of freedom, the requirements that go with living in a free society, which are in fact quite heavy, quite demanding. And it's those burdens that account for our wealth and power. It didn't just materialize because we were free. It came about because people undertook to bear the burdens of freedom. And the other groups in the country that are not individualists and the countries outside that are not, they bear a different set of burdens that I call the burdens of necessity. These are people who really don't think of life in terms of pursuing their own goals, but in terms of adjustment. So for them, the burdens are external, whereas for the West and for most Americans, they arise from our internal goals. We're under pressure because we want to achieve things. So we're inwardly burdened, and that is what makes us outwardly free. Whereas in the non-West, the opposite is the case. People accept outward burdens, and therefore they are less personally responsible for what happens to them. They're in an inward sense more free than an individualist because they accept that the burdens remain external. So that's basically the choice. And the West is unusual in having this inner-driven style. That isn't typical of the world. We think it's universal, but it isn't at all.
Right, right.
It's limited to the West, and the United States is probably the strongest individualist culture anywhere in the world. We don't see how distinct that is.
It seems to me then there are some different presuppositions here. The individualist culture that you're referring to, those who participate in it and help build it, must presuppose that the external world is in some degree malleable. That
yes,
it's not.
Don't assume that.
Yes, it's not driven by inner laws of necessity. History has to move in a particular direction. There's some malleability, and those of that other culture,
correct,
think that the world is fundamentally unchangeable.
Yeah. That's right. Now the West thinks as it does, tends to be activist and confident, optimistic. All of that is true. One reason we think that is that we've had a very fortunate history. There have only been brief moments in Western history when it looked like you couldn't control anything. There was really no hope. That has happened only very briefly. Whereas in the non-West, it's happened a great deal. And the areas where the world where people come from today as immigrants are areas which have had a much more tragic history than the West. Hmm. So there's a reason why when people come here from those worlds, they often are very cautious. They think in terms of adjustment and survival, and they don't have more ambitious goals. Now, once they live in this country for a few generations, then they tend to become more individualist. Mm-hmm. But that takes a while.
Do we tend to attract people from other countries who have a more individualist impulse?
Yes, I think that was true up until, let's say, World War II. I think until then, immigration to America was sufficiently difficult, even dangerous, to attract people who had a buccaneering individualist attitude.
Mm-hmm.
And they mostly came from Europe.
Yeah.
And that's not an accident. Europe was the origin of an individualist culture, and it stands to reason that people who weren't doing well in Europe, who didn't have opportunities there, who suffered political repression and so on, would climb on a ship and sail to America, even though it was risky to do that. But after World War II and the age of the airplane, transportation to the West became much, much easier than it was before. And for that reason, what the experts call selection among immigrants became much less demanding. So today, the majority of immigrants are not coming from the West. They're now coming from Latin America and Asia. And most of those people are not coming with a conscious choice to enter a free society. They're trying to get away from an unfree society where they don't have opportunities or where conditions of life are impossible, like in Central America. So their main goal is survival when they come to America. They're trying to get a better world. Doesn't mean that they understand the burdens of freedom. And when they get here, some of them are overwhelmed. The demands of living in this country are very real and very different from what they expect.
Let's go over some of those the burdens of freedom. You've mentioned it a few times.
Yeah.
Let's specify some of the conditions that make up the burdens of freedom.
Okay. The most obvious is that in a free society, we have, in fact, strong government. We have the rule of law. You have to obey the laws here and pay taxes. So our regime, although it is a free country that is protected against excesses of power, although that's true, we also take seriously the government we have. And we do, in fact, enforce the law. So a lot of people come here from countries where corruption is routine, where people don't really cooperate with the authorities. You can't get away with that in America.
Yeah.
We impose the obligations of citizenship on people, and we do that without apology and without significant concessions. So that's one thing. But the more important burdens have to do with those that follow from your own goals. If you come to a free country where people don't tell you what to do, you have to decide what to do. You have to decide what your life is about. And then, depending on what you decide, you have to take on responsibilities to achieve those goals. So the major burdens of freedom actually follow from the choices that people make to pursue their own lives. I mean, you and I, for example, characteristic of upper income or more fortunate achievers,
mm-hmm.
we set goals that require that we then do things.
Right.
I mean, it took me 3 or 4 years to write this book.
Yeah.
And during that time, that was the center of my life.
Right.
And I wasn't free to ignore that. I had decided to do this, and I must now do it.
That's right.
And most people in professional careers in America, and indeed virtually everyone who's part of the individualist culture, has goals like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where the burdens come from, the most serious ones. And those are the burdens that are not so present in the non-Western world. In those countries, you don't really have equal opportunity, which also means you don't have to compete. you don't have to struggle to get into a good school and then get into law school or business or whatever else you want to do. Those things are hard in America precisely because there is a free competition, and you have to get out there and prove yourself. So America's not for the faint of heart. You have to be willing to go out there and put yourself on the line.
So one of the key conditions that we must have in order to maintain that individualist achievement drive that you're referring to is you have to have a strong rule of law.
We do,
yeah,
and
you,
we do.
You got to keep the condition, because without that, you lose hope that you know, somebody's going to come and steal what you've achieved.
Yeah. I mean, one very clear fact about Latin America, for example, compared to the United States, if you just look at the surface of those countries, they have constitutions that look similar to ours. You go to their cities, and they have big skyscrapers like we do, and so on. But what you don't really have in those countries is a system of competitive opportunity, let's call it, where people can go to schools good enough to have a shot to get into the middle class afterwards. In America, you usually do. Now our schools, some of them are troubled. We're not satisfied with the schools we have, but we invest great effort and funding in those schools to provide something like equal opportunity for every American. That's our goal, and we take that very seriously. That's not so true in Latin America. The people who have opportunity tend to be people from very privileged circumstances, often from families that have been rich for generations, that originally came from Europe themselves, typically from Spain or some other part of the country that was part of the imperialist power that ran those countries. Now, that's true in America, too, in that people who've been in this country for a long time and who have been to good schools and their families are well-educated, they have advantages. But the difference is we take seriously the opportunity offered to other people who didn't come from a strong background. Now, it may not be a perfectly equal opportunity, but it's better than anywhere else in the world for people who come from nothing, who have no education and no background. Many people like that get ahead in America.
Right.
But in order to do that, they have to buckle down and work very hard. I mean, I have students like that in my classes here. Some of them come from strong backgrounds. Some of them don't. They're often first generation. They're children of immigrants. They're coming here from societies where there was very little education, very little opportunity. And when they come here, they have more, but they have to compete for it.
Right.
It's
right.
Not just given to them on a plate. We have this idea that freedom is a gift. Well, freedom is also a demand.
Right. Right. It has to be, freedom doesn't specify anything. It gives you the opportunity, but you've got to maintain that. Hold it there, Larry, we'll come back and continue conversation. The burdens of freedom, cultural difference, and American power.
Christ is the answer with Father John Ricardo.
John, chapter 8, verse 51. Jesus is in a discussion with some of the leaders of the Jews. They're talking about Abraham. Abraham lived 1,500 years before the time of Jesus. So in the course of the discussion, Jesus says, "Truly, truly, I say to you, if anyone keeps my word, he will never see death." He says that often in the Gospels. "He who keeps my word or believes in me will never die." To which the Jews say, "Now we know you have a demon." And they say, "Abraham died, as did the prophets, all the patriarchs, the great men and women of the history of Israel. All these people died, and you say, if anyone keeps my word, he will never taste death? Are you greater than our father Abraham, who died? And the prophets, who died?" And Jesus says, "Your father Abraham rejoiced that he was to see my day. He saw it and was glad." To which the Jews say, "You are not yet 50 years old, and you've seen Abraham?" And Jesus answers, "Truly, truly, I say to you, before Abraham was, I am."
Teaches that Jesus Christ is literally and wholly present, body and blood, soul and divinity, under the appearances of bread and wine. In the Bread of Life discourse, documented in John chapter 6, Jesus states that he is the bread of life, and that his flesh is true food and his blood true drink. The Jews were scandalized in verse 52. "How can this man give us his flesh to eat?" Jesus does not back down, but reiterates this teaching four more times over the next four verses. Many left in verse 66 because this teaching was truly difficult. But at no point does Jesus water down his teaching and call them back. No, he allows them to leave, and even questions his 12 apostles if they too wish to leave. Jesus intended to be understood literally, and the Jews, apostles, and the Catholic Church absolutely take him at his word. Examining the truth of the Catholic faith, this is faithforensics.org.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Ave Maria School of Law is the Roman Catholic law school in the United States. Consistently ranked in the Princeton Review as one of the best and most conservative law schools, as well as pre-law's most devout law school. Ave Maria School of Law provides a traditional legal education while emphasizing how the law intersects with the Catholic intellectual tradition and natural law philosophy. Ave Maria School of Law, unabashedly Catholic, consistently excellent. For more information, visit avemarialaw.edu.
Cresta in the Afternoon is underwritten by the following nonprofit organization. Real Estate for Life. Buying or selling your home or business property? Real Estate for Life can connect you with one of 1,400 pro-life real estate agents around the world. When Real Estate for Life receives a referral fee, they donate 70% to Ave Maria Radio and Human Life International. More information at realestateforlife.org or 877-LIFE-US1. That's realestateforlife.org.
St. Therese once told her sister Celine that when we trust ourselves and not God, our soul becomes barren and incapable of virtue. Her remedy? External works of charity. We all try to do it on our own sometimes without asking for God's help. At St. Paul Evangelization, we suggest sharing the gospel with someone who needs it. Check out streetevangelization.com to find a team near you where you can share the love of Jesus. If there isn't one in your area yet, perhaps God is calling you to start a team in your city. To learn more, visit streetevangelization.com.
And good afternoon. I'm Al Cresta. With me, Dr. Lawrence Mead, author most recently of Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power. The book really offers a breath of fresh air because it talks candidly about the importance of recognizing cultural differences between what has developed in Europe and the West as opposed to other sectors of the world. I want to come back to this question of the individualist achieving culture that has developed in the West. Where do we trace this from?
I have a chapter on that. It's not entirely clear where it comes from, but the clearest simple origin is that Europe was settled by Germanic tribes from elsewhere in Europe, from the East really, at the time of the Roman Empire and the collapse of the Roman Empire several millennia ago. And those tribes had an individualist temperament. The leadership was competitive. Kings were faced with rivalry by their peers. They were accountable to their societies. It was a pushy, impatient culture where people didn't just exist. They thought in terms of changing and improving it and proving their personal capabilities. Mm-hmm. That was a central value in those cultures. And that temperament gets passed to Europe as a whole. And there are other features are the influence of the biblical religion. Judaism and Christianity are individualist creeds. Mm-hmm. Although they're very old, they express a very individualist idea of the person. And the person is given great responsibility to pursue God's will, but at the same time, they have to figure out what God's will is. So there's considerable trust placed in the individual. At the same time, responsibility in the form of inner commandments, which you have to obey. And an important part of individualism is a moralistic temperament where we have abstract, generalized, principled ideas of right and wrong, which we then impose on ourselves and on other people and on government. And that's why the culture is a moralistic character, where people argue about what to do, but they argue in moralistic terms about what's right and what's wrong. And that isn't so true in the non-West, where the moral structure isn't based on internalized principles so much as on conformity to social expectations. You do what other people expect you to do, and that's what right and wrong means in those cultures. Hmm. Well, that's not the American style.
Right.
We're influenced by other people, but in the end, right and wrong are determined by principles, which we learn usually early in life, and we then expect ourselves and others to live up to. And of course, nobody perfectly lives up to them, so there's continual jostling about what is right and wrong and who is at fault and who isn't at fault. And this leads to a fractious, competitive, argumentative character in American culture. And although it can be difficult, it takes some getting used to, it takes a thick skin often, but it drives the country forward.
Mm-hmm.
And most of what we do, we aim to justify in terms of these internal principles.
Now, within Christianity itself, though, Latin America has a strong Catholic base. North America has a strong, even though it had Catholic settlements early, we generally think of America as having a largely Protestant history.
Yeah.
So tell me the difference, cultural consequences between these two different forms of Christian, looking at the cultural consequences here.
Yeah, the individualism comes from Europe. That is a great fact. Europe is the originator of the individualist culture.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the forces behind it, actually, is the medieval church, the Catholic Church, prior to the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
That is the place, it's the Catholic Church which is responsible largely for creating a moralistic culture of compliance with right and wrong.
Mm-hmm.
And then with the Reformation and the development of Protestantism, you have a more individualistic version of that same creed. Even Catholicism is individualist, after all.
Right.
It does have a strong authority structure with the papacy and the bishops and the hierarchy. Protestantism criticizes that and has a looser hierarchy. But the fundamental creed is the same. In both cases, individuals are trusted to take responsibility for their lives. And they have standards to meet, but they also have many choices to make. And that is not so true in religious life outside the West. Those other religions, Islam, Buddhism, a number of others, they are more oriented to conformity, to ratifying the world as it is, rather than setting standards for improvement. So all those various versions of Christianity came to America, and the strongest influence initially certainly is Protestantism. That is certainly the case, and
mm-hmm.
that's one of the reasons why America is so individualist. However, Catholics have become more individualists over time, and now their attitudes towards things are not really very different from Protestants. And this is something that the Roman Church struggles with. They deal all the time with the tendency for American Catholics to make their own judgments about things,
sure.
not necessarily take the guidance of the hierarchy.
Right.
So, and the hierarchy, for their purposes, have learned to behave like politicians. They have their ears to the ground. They care what other people think. They want to get the consent of their people in the congregations. Now, in theory, the Catholic Church is a top-down authority structure. But in practice, there's a lot of deference to the attitudes of people in the pews. So in the end, I think what's happened to the Catholic Church is, represents the triumph of sociology over theology. You know, the difference between Catholicism and Protestantism has diminished over time, precisely because the Catholic flock has become more individualist over time.
That's interesting. There's certainly changes that have occurred in Catholic social teaching, too. You take a look at some of the differences between John Paul II's social encyclical Centesimus Annus and compare that to earlier work, and it seems to me you do see growing acceptance of the value of free markets and individual initiative in that respect. Yeah.
Well, that goes back to the late 19th century, the first important encyclical, I think it's Leo VII.
Leo XIII, the Rerum Novarum,
Yes, that's the first. And there you see the Catholic Church coming to terms with capitalism.
Right.
And seeking to, and that actually goes back into the Middle Ages. The Catholic Church has always accepted capitalism in some form.
That's right.
At the same time, there's moral criticism of the limitations of capitalism.
Right.
But that's also true among Protestants. That no church gives gives capitalism a complete bill of health. There's always criticism of its shortcomings and the need to change things through governmental action. And that is something that Americans tend to agree about. So the religious differences here are really not very important. What is more important, I would say, is that in the Catholic structure, the hierarchy still claims a right to speak for the laity, whereas in the other denominations, the laity speak for themselves
mm-hmm.
much more.
Sure.
I think that's a difference. But the message isn't all that different.
What have we learned in America about the welfare reforms of the 90s, and which seem to have been, I think, being forgotten? But go ahead.
Yeah. The main fact about the welfare reform is that we required welfare mothers to go to work as a condition of aid. We didn't do this in all of welfare, but we did it for the family aid program known as Aid to Families with Dependent Children. That program was essentially abolished and replaced by a program where work was much more often expected for welfare mothers. Now, what's notable about that is that most experts and most intellectuals and the Roman Catholic hierarchy opposed that.
Mm-hmm.
They did not accept that you should require welfare mothers to work.
Right.
But the Catholic lady did accept it, indeed strongly endorsed it, as did other people. And then the reform was almost completely successful, in that the mothers left welfare and went out and got jobs, most of them. Now, later on, and this is more recent, evidence has appeared that some few mothers, maybe 5%, small number, left welfare and didn't get work and emerged worse off. So there are some downsides to this. There are people who were hurt by it. And experts, even those like myself who favor the reform, we recognize that something has to be done about what's called the detached mothers, people who are not working and also not on welfare. So we do think some fine-tuning is called for. But we think the reform in general was still a big success, and it was endorsed by most Americans,
right,
but opposed by the intellectual class. That is right. The thing that is really remarkable about it.
In fact, today, that again, you still hear it out there that somehow this was a cruel reform.
Yeah, correct.
And plays into now this question about with immigration. And we used to believe that citizenship was necessary. And today it seems as though there is not an interest, and you can speak to the specifics on this. I'm speaking to the general impression. The general impression I think Americans have is that we've lost the idea that immigrants coming to the United States need to somehow embrace the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, you know, and that right now we're willing to accept anybody who simply shows up. I'm exaggerating, but tell me about this debate.
Well, the immigration question is complicated, but the public is correct in viewing immigration as essentially out of control. That's true. Under current rules, virtually anybody can cross the border and claim asylum in America, and then their case is supposed to be adjudicated by an immigration court system. But because those cases are long delayed, many people end up living in the United States illegally. So we don't really now have a right to refuse immigrants who come here claiming oppression in their own countries. If they claim that, then they get a right to stay in America, effectively. Now, that's excessive. That ought to be changed. But the background problem of immigration is not actually a matter of law or details. It really has to do with the cultural conflict between the people who are now coming from the non-Western world and those who previously came largely from the West. The immigrants of 100 years ago, the last time we had a big wave of immigrants, came mostly from Europe. And so for them, the individual's lifestyle was not so foreign as it now is. Our current immigrants are coming from Asia and Latin America, and especially the Hispanics coming from Central America and Mexico. They have a hard time in America because they're not used to an individualist society. And they have to obey a lot of rules they didn't have to obey in the old country. They have to compete in school. Schools are terrifying to them. Immigrants from those countries have a hard time competing. They're not used to this. And they don't usually do well, and they have many social problems. And that's also true of other minorities whose origins lie outside the Western world. Blacks whose origins go to slavery, also Native Americans. These groups all have a hard time in American society. We used to think that that's due to a special set of barriers that they face. Well, I'm not saying there have never been barriers, but at present, the overwhelming fact is cultural conflict, that these groups represent a more cautious, more collective temperament than the society assumes. The society was created by people from Europe. And that's why these groups from outside the West are having a hard time.
Yeah. I thought Asians had a fairly high accomplishment status
they
in
do.
The U.S.
They do. In fact, this is the point which some people have raised against my argument, and you have to be very precise in answering it. Asians do very well in school. As long as there's a clear structure that defines what success is, Asians work hard and they learn what they're supposed to learn, and they do very well in terms of grades and test scores and all that. And that's why they do very well getting into good colleges. And it looks like it's a story of complete success. But the thing that people don't notice is that they don't do very well after school. And the reason is they're not individualists. The average Asian is hardworking. However, they don't have much idea about what they want to do or what they think about things. What's lacking is the individualist element, which America presumes.
Yeah.
And especially after school, when you go to college, when you're a university teacher, as I am, you expect students to make individualist arguments. They have to say things that are what they think, and they have to make a case for what they think, and they have to engage in arguing with people who differ. And especially leadership in America requires not just answering questions posed by other people. That's the Asian style. Rather, you have to decide what the questions are.
The internal drivenness.
So, and the Asian style is not inner driven. Now, of course, there are exceptions.
Sure.
I mean, right now, I have an Asian in my current class who's extremely assertive about many things. But that's not typically the Asian style.
Gotcha.
So their problem, as for the Latinos, is actually to become more individualist.
Larry, thank you so much. I greatly appreciate your willingness to take on the cultural difference here. I'm looking forward to really spending a lot of time in the book. Thank you.
Well, thank you.
Do you have a teenager at home who's full of potential? Too often the world is telling you to be content with mediocrity instead of raising respectful and responsible young adults with strong character. Hi, everybody. I'm Dr. Ray. If you need some help, not only to navigate those teen years, but to really enjoy them, check out my book, Standing Strong, Good Discipline Makes Great Teens, as well as my other books, on the store page at AveMariaRadio.net.
Do you own popular index mutual funds or ETFs? If so, you're automatically own shares of companies that conflict with your moral beliefs. Ave Maria mutual funds are managed to conform to pro-life and pro-family values. Long-term investors can invest in the no-load Ave Maria mutual funds. The experienced professional portfolio managers make decisions based on investment fundamentals and pro-life values. You can learn more about Ave Maria mutual funds today at 866-AVE-MARIA or visit AveMariaFunds.com.
The following program is brought to you in part by MyCatholicWill.com. Surveys show that more than half of Americans do not have a will. At MyCatholicWill.com, it takes as little as 15 minutes to write your will and secure a legacy of faith. MyCatholicWill.com is the exclusive online destination for creating a Catholic will. The process of writing a will is simple and now more accessible than ever. MyCatholicWill.com, a legacy of faith for those you love.
This program brought to you in part by the town of Ave Maria, Florida.
Ave Maria, a big kind of small town. A golf cart friendly, ride your bike everywhere kind of town with something for everyone. Resort style amenities, two golf courses, shopping, and dining in our town center. With Ave Maria University and Ave Maria Catholic Church at the core of the community and a wide range of homes to meet your family's needs. Visitors are welcome. More information can be found at AveMaria.com. Ave Maria, a big kind of small town.
What is the life of our heart? The Catholic Catechism answers prayer is the life of the new heart. It ought to be the source of our animation at every moment, but we tend to forget the one who is our all. The fathers of the spiritual life in the Deuteronomic and prophetic tradition say that prayer is a remembrance of God often awakened by the memory of the heart. We are to remember God more often, says the Catechism, than we draw breath. We cannot, however, pray at all times if we have not learned to pray at specific times. The tradition of the Church proposes morning and evening prayer, grace before and after meals, the liturgy of the hours, Sundays centered on the Eucharist, the cycle of the liturgical year with its great feasts as the basic rhythms of the Christian's life of prayer. There are three major expressions of prayer: vocal, meditative, and contemplative. This is Peggy Stanton, and this has been the Order of Malta's Minute with the Catechism.
It's time for Family Man with Dr. Gregory Popchak.
Parents often complain that their kids either don't do their chores or don't do a good job with them. How can parents teach kids to do chores well? The easiest way to teach kids healthy attitudes toward chores is to create family work rituals where families do chores together. Daily family work rituals give parents and kids an opportunity to work side by side, learning good stewardship, responsibility, and teamwork. Family work rituals provide on-the-job training for chores so that when kids eventually get their own chores, they know what's expected of them and how to do them well. That's one reason family rituals for working together are such an important part of Catholic family life. To discover more ways your family can celebrate the liturgy of domestic church life, check out the newest editions of Parenting with Grace and visit CatholicCounselors.com. I'm Dr. Greg Popchak, but you can call me Family Man.
To discover more ways faith can enrich your life, visit CatholicCounselors.com.
And good afternoon, I'm Al Cresta. Thank you for being here. I want to follow up on Larry Mead's book, Burdens of Freedom, Cultural Difference in American Power. You know, the thesis of the book, again, is that the United States is an individualist society where most people seek to realize personal goals and values by achievement in the world. This is an unusual culture. It's an inner-driven culture. And in fact, you don't see it very much around the world. It emerges first of all in Europe, then Britain, and now in America. And that's why these three areas, Europe, Britain, and America, came to lead the world. But today, our deepest problems are deriving from groups and activists and even nations that reflect a more passive, deferential temperament than the West. And I wanted to pick up on a small point that he makes in the book about the origins of this Western concept of the achieving individual. And I first of all want to say that whenever we discuss characteristics of culture, right, people accuse you of what? Of making generalizations. They get uncomfortable. In fact, sometimes when you say positive things about your own culture, you're accused of xenophobia or even racism, as though culture is somehow a function of skin pigmentation. But a few generations ago, popular and academic writers were not ashamed to champion the virtues of the West. This has become, after 9/11, there were many, many books that came out looking at the question of Western civilization. A lot of them were praised the West, but in muted tones. But a few generations ago, they were not so muted. People would describe how the West was created from this remarkable confluence, the stream of influence from the classical world of Greece and Rome, merging with the Hebrew Christian tradition, and then later the Anglo and European Enlightenment. And it's formed this mighty river that we call Western civilization that had so irrigated the world and brought forth great fruits of art and literature and science and the revolution in human rights and the freedoms that we all take for granted in the U.S. Constitution. And even the United Nations Declaration of Human Rights was a great product of the Western conscience. Catholics in particular, by the way, were proud of the Church's preservation of classical culture because it was the Benedictine monks of late antiquity that preserved that culture. They are the ones that provided light during the Dark Ages. They didn't produce the Dark Ages. They were the light in the so-called Dark Ages. And out of that came the barbarian conversions. And the barbarians, after their conversion, worship one God and eventually gave us this cultural entity that we call Europe. And the achievements of the High Middle Ages saw an embryonic scientific enterprise developing. It saw the synthesis of faith and reason. It saw the foundation of what today we call the human rights revolution. Now, it's true that sometimes these writers who praised and extolled the strengths of the West, maybe they weren't all properly critical of some of the problems of the West, like racial slavery and white supremacy or lack of compassion in the use of accumulated wealth. But one of the great strengths of the West, and this emerges directly from the Christian tradition, is self-criticism. In fact, it was exactly this capacity for self-criticism and change that enabled the Western tradition to eventually abandon the practice of racial slavery and reject the folly of white supremacy and become a post-colonial world. This introspective conscience is what it's sometimes called. This introspective conscience can be traced back to St. Augustine's Confessions and, of course, the Catholic practice of examination of conscience and confession of sin. One of the most important essays, but there's a little side note here. One of the most important essays in New Testament studies over the last two generations was written by Christer Stendahl, a Lutheran theologian and scholar, called The Apostle Paul and the Introspective Conscience of the West. And to make a long story short, Stendahl points out that the quest of the plagued conscience for absolution begins with St. Augustine, the Confessions, which he calls the first great document in the history of introspective conscience, and in his mind climaxes with Luther. But Stendahl makes the important point that Luther had misread St. Paul. He thought that St. Paul's issues were his issues. Luther read his own preoccupation with a guilty conscience back into his interpretation of Paul. But Luther's preoccupation with this anguished, accusing conscience was not St. Paul's issue. And this has become a staple now of New Testament scholarship. St. Paul agonized, he did, but not over the state of his own conscience. In fact, in Philippians 3, he tells us he was a Hebrew of Hebrew, a Pharisee of Pharisees. As to the law, he was faultless. Paul didn't lose sleep over his guilty conscience. He lost sleep over the unity of the church and the way that the Jewish members of the Christian church were trying to force Gentiles to be circumcised and follow dietary laws and take the Jewish Sabbaths and basically become Jews. St. Paul knew that there was a new messianic community, the community of Christ, the church, which was a universal church and brought Jew and Gentile together. That's what St. Paul agonized over. Luther agonized over a guilty conscience. So this introspective conscience of the West today is still alive and at work, and it plagues those who have lost faith in the Western project. And that includes many of our academic and cultural elites. In fact, the only time they make generalizations about Western culture is when they want to loathe it. Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western civ has got to go. And this is dangerous as well as silly. It's dangerous and silly to saw off the very limb you're sitting on. They're sitting on the limb of Western self-criticism, drawn from the Christian tradition of examination of conscience and confession of sin. But they lack the faith that made the West. And because of that, their loathing and their criticism is fruitless and destructive. Have you noticed that Americans love to think that no one is bound by cultural influences? A lot of Americans hate explanations that make any of us sound like we're just a product of genetics or a product of society or culture. That itself, that resistance, is strong evidence of how much we in the West have been champions of the individual, the self, the creative person made in the image and likeness of God. We don't believe we're ultimately bound by our culture any more than we're ultimately bound by genetic determinism. So what Larry Mead illustrates is that one major influence in the development of the West's emphasis on the individual, his inner directed achievements, come from biblical religion, both Catholicism and Protestantism, this side of the incarnation. Both the Old and New Testaments express a faith that promoted and also disciplined individualism like no other did. Eastern spirituality and religion don't emphasize definite moral commandments. They also tend to escape the world. The goal of reincarnation, for instance, is not to be reborn into this world. That's a tragedy. Islam, which became Christianity's great rival in the West, does contain definite moral commandments, but it resists individualism. Judaism and Christianity, however, both embraced freedom while at the same time calling individuals to higher purposes and to moral behavior. That's the faith that defined Europe and gave it a transcendental goal. Going back to the ancient Israelites, their neighbors in the ancient Near East, in Mesopotamia and in Egypt, understood time as cyclical, not in a forward direction. And they mainly sought to placate natural forces that humans couldn't understand. Judaism, however, conceived of a God who controlled this world and stood entirely outside of it, and yet at the same time could relate to the individuals he had created in his image and likeness to challenge them and affirm them and judge them. So while God would make covenant with the people of Israel, each Israelite was expected to live the covenant heroically. There's a defining moment in the history of the West, and it's actually a defining moment in salvation history as well. It's in Genesis 22, where God tells Abraham to sacrifice his beloved son Isaac. So he does it. Obediently, he steps forward to sacrifice Isaac, but God says no, and he provides a ram instead. An angel then says to Abraham, because you've obeyed God's will, I will bless you, and I will multiply your descendants as the stars of the heavens and the sands of the sea. And your descendants shall possess the gates of their enemies, and by your descendants shall all the nations of the earth bless themselves, because you have obeyed my voice. This passage contains a profound insight that ends up becoming central to the future of all Western experience. to internalize God's will produces and promotes order that is not contrary to freedom. Remember, big conflict. How do you maintain order without destroying freedom? How do you maintain order and continue to give people the freedom to do as they interiorly desire to do? So the moral principles that the Western individual imbibes makes them, first of all, steer away from obvious faults and sins and bad behaviors. But those principles also motivate them to serve and better themselves and work for the betterment of others. So a person possessed by a moral cause has the strength of 10 who lack that inspiration. Now, more conformist personalities, those who are just trying to survive because external conditions, they regard external conditions as unchangeable, they don't make the impact on the world that the achieving, internally driven individual does. Western culture, even in the Middle Ages, by the way, had substantial room to innovate, and they did so. And that brought constant change. The whole view of the Middle Ages has been changed tremendously. The Middle Ages are now seen not as a stagnant period, but as an incredibly creative period. You have, in fact, most people don't even use the phrase the Dark Ages anymore, because the church, the light coming from the church in its preservation of the classics of ancient civilization, that was the light during the so-called Dark Ages. And little by little, as the church made Christians of the barbarians, things began to emerge by a gospel, a good news that told people that they were created in the image and likeness of God, but were fallen because of, again, moral disobedience. However, they could be regenerated and reborn through Jesus. And it's that concept of the person that has given us the Western freedoms we enjoy today and the burdens that come with that freedom. Again, you take a look at the Middle Ages and the opening of trade routes to India and China by Franciscan monks, the synthesis of faith and reason by Thomas Aquinas, the civilizing of Ireland, called the land of saints and scholars. You look at the cultivation of Germany and the Slavic lands, the agricultural revolution that was birthed by the invention of the heavy plow, the dike system of Holland that was developed by Cistercian monks as they reclaimed the land from the sea. So what you have throughout the Middle Ages is a dynamic culture that has given us the West that we enjoy today, the product of an unusual amalgam of influences drawn from classical Greece and Rome and the Hebrew Christian tradition. That's how we have the freedoms we have today and the burdens that go along with being a free people.
Father Benedict Rochelle.
I'm going to tell you about the most abused woman I ever met in my life. You know her name as Roe, as in Roe versus Wade. I talked to Roe. This woman is a great penitent. This woman is a humble person who was deeply hurt. She was kneeling in the Basilica of the Immaculate Conception, the National Shrine in Washington, when I met her. And I thought, what reverence. I didn't know who this woman was, but she was praying with reverence, with great fervor. And I asked a priest friend of mine, who is that? And he says, oh, that's Roe. God is not mocked. This woman was abused by those who propagate the killing of children.
The people you know and trust are on EWTN. Catholic Connection with Teresa Tomeo.
Learn and spread the word about the food, clothing, parenting classes, financial assistance that these resource centers provide moms, and not just for a few weeks after the baby is born, but often for up to 4 years after birth. Don't assume that just because you haven't heard about pro-life resources or efforts that they don't or aren't available, or that the church hasn't been involved. The media, and I know this firsthand from my years of experience, have been working with the abortion industry to suppress information about resources, as well as totally misrepresent or blatantly lie about what the pro-life community offers moms and families in need. And last but not least, do some homework and prayerfully give thanks to these pro-life warriors and consider becoming a pro-life warrior yourself.
Catholic Connections, Teresa Tomeo. Weekdays, 9 a.m. Eastern on EWTN Radio.
Thanks for being with us on that special Memorial Day edition of Cresta in the Afternoon. If you go to AveMariaRadio.net, you can follow up on the conversations that we had today. We'll have lots of books available for you there, and as well as some different articles and things. Wanted to close today. This was a National Catholic Register published a prayer for Memorial Day, and it simply goes, God of power and mercy, you destroy war and put down earthly pride. Banish violence from our midst and wipe away our tears, that we may all deserve to be called your sons and daughters. Keep in your mercy those men and women who have died in the cause of freedom, and bring them safely into your kingdom of justice and peace. We ask it through Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen. Have a blessed evening. We'll see you tomorrow.
Cresta in the Afternoon is a co-production of Ave Maria Radio and EWTN Radio, and carried across the EWTN Global Catholic Radio Network. To follow up on any of the guests or information presented on today's program, visit the Cresta Guest Archive at AveMariaRadio.net. That's AveMaria Radio.net. To listen to this or any other edition of Cresta in the Afternoon, visit the audio archives at AveMariaRadio.net. Or to order a CD of the program, call 734-930-4506 or email orders at AveMariaRadio.net. That's 734-930-4506 or orders at AveMariaRadio.net.